much, Melody. Now we have Patty Sesker talking about foreign policy and its impact on abortion internationally.
Thank you. Good morning, everybody. My name is Patty Schuster, which is hard to pronounce. No, everybody pronounces this wrong. And I also work for IPAS, which Melody explained is an international reproductive rights organization. We're based in Chapel Hill, and we work on training, research, equipping providers, and also policy work on the issue of unsafe abortion, and then also trying to make safe abortion available. And what I'm going to talk about mostly is focus on the harm of U.S. foreign policy on some of the work that we're doing, but also the work of our partners around the world. And in my presentation, in the short time that I have, I'm going to talk quickly about abortion law and policy globally, just to sort of lay out a context in which a U.S. action happens. And then I'll explain two of the major restrictions on abortion in U.S. foreign policy. And then lastly, move into giving some examples of the harm of these policies in Ethiopia, in Kenya, Nigeria, Nepal, and then another small example here in the U.S. And here's my disclosure, no relationships to disclose. So this is laying out the global context. We know that in the past 12 years, governments in 17 countries have reformed their abortion laws to make them less restrictive, and the list is here. And three countries, meanwhile, have made their laws more restrictive. So just want to lay out that we can call this a trend globally of governments increasingly and activists increasingly working to make abortion, safe abortion, more available. And Melody nicely laid this out, that we're dealing with a situation where 67,000 women are dying and millions of women suffering injury. We have a statistic that 5 million women annually are globally are hospitalized from unsafe abortion. And recognizing this, governments around the world have gotten together to say that unsafe abortion is a major problem, and that where abortion is legal, we need to train and equip providers to make abortion safe and available. And these are some of the treaties, particularly the ICPD, which is the International Conference on Population and Development, in 1994, and then again in 1999, governments came together to say, we have a problem of unsafe abortion, and we need to make abortion safe where it's legal. And the U.S. was part of those negotiations, in fact, a leader in those negotiations in 1994. And then Melody also mentioned the Maputo Plan of Action, the Protocol of the Rights of Women, and then international human rights treaties that don't explicitly mention abortion, but when human rights authorities have come together, they've said unsafe abortion is a matter of human rights. Lack of access to safe abortion services is a problem and at times a violation of human rights. So I'm going to talk about two U.S. foreign policies. And I mean, I think most of us in the room recognize that if I were to talk about all of the U.S. foreign policies that violate women's reproductive rights, my time would be up because there are so many. So I'm going to focus just on two. And these two policies in particular are providing serious challenges to our work to reduce death and injury from unsafe abortion. And the first one is the 1973 Helms Amendment, and that was enacted the year after Roe v. Wade. Its namesake, Senator Jesse Helms, pioneered the amendment to the U.S. Foreign Operations Authorization Act in 1973. And what that says is no U.S. foreign assistance can be used to perform counsel or advocate for abortions abroad. And to sort of give an idea of what the impact of this policy is, I do want to mention that the United States United States Agency for International Development, or USAID, is actually the largest bilateral funder of family planning services in the world. So that means governments giving to other governments or governments giving to NGOs. In fact, USAID provides 40% of all the bilateral family planning funding. So just to say that when the U.S. makes a policy about how USAID funds are spent, it has a tremendous impact, really, in the entire field of reproductive health. And in 2001, as probably many of you are familiar, President Bush, in his first act of office, enacted the Global Gag Rule. And the Global Gag Rule is a complement, in a bad way, to the Helms Amendment in that it tells organizations what they can do with their own money. So the Helms Amendment tells organizations what they can and cannot do with USAID money, but the Global Gag Rule says, well, with your own money, you cannot counsel, provide abortion services, refer, or advocate for less restrictive abortion laws. And just to explain how onerous the global gag rule is, I want to mention that it actually does not apply to U.S. organizations because it would be unconstitutional if it applied to U.S. organizations. Under the U.S. Constitution, it would be a violation of free speech to sort of hang out money as a condition of money, tell people that they have to forego their constitutional rights. And that was settled in a 1985 case, settled for the bad, where the U.S. District Court in the D.C. Circuit said foreign organizations don't actually have the protection of the U.S. Constitution. That is, the U.S. in its foreign policy can actually violate the human rights of organizations and governments outside the U.S. So I'm going to talk about the harm of the global gag rule first, and Melanie, again, you can tell that Melody and I work together because we kind of tag-teamed on this. She alluded to it in the situation of Ethiopia. And I'm going to talk about Ethiopia, and I'm going to talk about Kenya. And I think the global gag rule has really been well-documented since 2001. There's actually a website, globalgagrule.org, that's managed by Population Action International, who has sent a lot of people, including me, prior to IPAS, out to try to figure out and document what is the impact, how is the global gag rule playing out overseas. And Ethiopia, as Melody mentioned, recently changed their abortion law and had been working with a large coalition. A large coalition had been working together of women lawyers, of reproductive health organizations, of doctors. The Society for Obstetricians and Gynecologists actually was a leading organization in the law reform process. And what makes the global gag rule particularly onerous to law reform is the fact that USAID is a large funder of post-abortion care. That is, they're a large funder of training and equipping providers, or training providers, to provide care for women who suffer from complications of unsafe abortion. So although USAID won't fund induced abortion, it will treat women, fund treatment for women who have suffered complications. And so that means that a lot of the providers who, particularly in Ethiopia and other countries, who have been faced with women who have suffered complications or have seen women die from unsafe abortion are the same ones who are gagged. We found a lot of places where we work, medical providers, and we have a medical provider right here who's good testimony to that, are often the biggest proponents of abortion law reform because they're the ones who are actually seeing women come to them and seeing the infertility, a permanent infertility, and seeing women die. But a lot of these same people are USAID funded, and therefore, in Ethiopia, as an example, when the abortion law was being debated, these individuals and organizations weren't able to participate in the debate because they were gagged. And I just want to point to, this is from our country director, Saba Kadani Mariam, in Ethiopia, who said there's withdrawal from USAID funding from certain NGOs, and this intimidates others who would like to speak out. NGOs often fear even remote association with abortion. The U.S. policies affect who can engage in debate because of repercussions some may face. So there's a real environment, and was and continues to be a real environment, of fear and intimidation. And although we were successful, and the organizations and the individuals in Ethiopia working on law reform were successful, the law is, the abortion, it still remains in the criminal law. And if someone tries to access an abortion outside those indications that Melody talked about, there still are criminal penalties in the law for women and for providers. So it's not an ideal situation. And some of that may, I mean, it's hard to say, but it may be due to the fact that a lot of people weren't able to participate in the debate. And before I move off of the global gag rule, I'll mention, too, that I'm mostly talking about law reform here, but there's been a lot of good documentation of how services have been impacted as well. And I'm going to give the example of the International Planned Parenthood Federation, which has affiliates all over the world, like our Planned Parenthood Federation of America. There's also one, I'll give the example of Nepal, the Planned Parenthood, the Family Planning Association of Nepal is a good example of an organization that was really affected by the global gag rule because they refused to sign. So here, I've just spoken about organizations who signed and sort of waived their right to speak, but there were a lot of other organizations who refused to sign and chose not to sign and therefore lost a lot of money. IPPF affiliates happen to have had a long relationship going back to the 70s with USAID, where USAID provided a lot of funding for IPPF affiliates in order for them to build their expertise in providing family planning services, reproductive health care, and well baby care, even immunizations, a whole range of reproductive health and infant even services. Once they had that expertise, they were the leading organization in many, many countries, including Nepal. And so a lot of IPPF affiliates refused to sign the global gag rule, which I haven't mentioned is also called the Mexico City policy, and therefore lost funding. And I have an example of Nepal that they lost 40%, $400,000 in contraceptive funding, $100,000 in cash funding, and then had to close 60 clinics throughout Nepal. And so because they had that expertise, I mean, it's not like funding levels went down, they were the same, but it was going to other organizations and other organizations who weren't the leading family planning providers in the region. And so women weren't able to access care as well. Oh, so I just realized I had that little trick, so this is going to cover that up. So now I'm going to turn to the Helms Amendment. And the Helms Amendment has been less well documented. The Helms Amendment has been around since the 70s. There hasn't been a lot of organization around trying to get rid of the Helms Amendment. It hasn't been a lot of documentation of the impact of the Helms Amendment. But what we've done is talk to some of our country directors and also have funded a study in Nepal to sort of try to tease out what is the impact of the Helms Amendment. How is this prohibition on USAID funds harming efforts to address unsafe abortion? And I'm going to talk about Nepal. Nepal is a country that changed its abortion law in 2002, and this was part of a large effort largely led by women's rights advocates. It was part of a whole package of reforms at that time. It was a package of reforms that changed laws that were discriminatory against women, laws like property inheritance laws, strengthening violence against women protections, and then also liberalizing the abortion law. So now early abortion in Nepal has no restriction whatsoever. And the Helms Amendment, what we found through this study that we did in Nepal is that the Helms Amendment has really stood in the way of the Nepali government's efforts to try to make safe abortion available. So the law was changed, but when the law was changed, the Nepali government then wanted to try to make safe abortion available in public facilities. And USAID in Nepal, like other countries, is a huge funder of post-abortion care and also family planning, but I want to focus on the post-abortion care. So there are a lot of facilities that provide both family planning and post-abortion care funded by USAID. But USAID, shortly after the law was reformed, created a memorandum of understanding with the Nepali government. And that memorandum of understanding said that you will not use Nepali government USAID-funded facilities to do abortion care. So sort of think about it, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. You can't use USAID-funded facilities that are being used to provide post-abortion care, to provide family planning, to provide other reproductive health services. If you're going to provide abortion, it has to go somewhere else. And just sort of another technical note to explain why this is so onerous, post-abortion care, if someone shows up who has had an incomplete abortion, who's gone to a clandestine, unsafe provider and the abortion wasn't complete, a lot of times providers will use a manual vacuum aspirator to evacuate the uterus, and that's actually the same equipment and a similar technique that's used for induced abortion as well. But despite this, that equipment, if it's USAID, or that those facilities, if they're USAID funded, can't be used for abortion. And so under that memorandum of understanding, it made things very complicated. So for example, when the Nepali government wanted to begin training providers, it had a perfectly suitable facility in Kathmandu, a maternity hospital, to provide it, to train providers on post-abortion care, to train providers on induced abortion. It was a facility that provided post-abortion care, but because it was USAID funded, they couldn't use it. So they had to wait and build a whole new facility in the same location rather than use the one that would have been suitable. And what's happened under the Memorandum of Understanding, because people are scared, wherever USAID funds are being used or have been used in the past, facilities are off limits for abortion services. So this is what some of the government providers have said, that even if USAID funded a facility, they're not even funding the facility anymore. It still is not supposed to be used for abortion care. And that also seriously impacts the quality of care because, induced abortion is followed up by post-abortion counseling for contraceptive. But the contraception and the family planning services are happening in a whole other different facility. So you have the abortion care isolated and then all the other reproductive health care happening in a whole other place. And there have been studies that have shown that if the contraceptive is offered in a different location following an abortion, a person is less likely to begin using contraception after that. So that's been a real huge problem. And I just want to mention, too, that under the Helms Amendment, USAID funds cannot be used to purchase manual vacuum aspirators. And so that USAID funds, even though those particular pieces of equipment can be used to provide post-abortion care, and USAID funds post-abortion care, it won't fund the equipment. So there are really kind of complicated things that have to happen, and our Nigeria country director has spoken to this, where we're doing a lot of post-abortion care that USAID providers are trained, but they need to find funding elsewhere to try to get the equipment. So it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to train providers without equipping them actually with the services. And what I do want to mention also is that these particular policies aren't affecting all women in Nepal, and they're not affecting all women in Nigeria or all women in Kenya. It's really the poorest women in these countries. It's not only the poorest countries in the world, but it's the women in those countries who are accessing public health services through public health facilities or through NGOs. It's just like here, still women with resources are able to go to private providers, but meanwhile, it's the poorest women that are really targeted by U.S. foreign policy, basically because they're able to do that. I'm going to mention one other impact. Okay, I'm going to very, very quickly mention one other impact of the Helms Amendment. You all might remember in the news back in April of 2008, the Baltimore Sun and also some research librarians had sort of broken this news that abortion had turned into a non-searchable term on the USAID-funded database POPLINE. So Johns Hopkins University runs a database full of reproductive health information called POPLINE, and abortion was removed as a term to search. So abortion was turned into a term like the, for example. If you type abortion, nothing comes up. And the reason that that happened, it finally all came to light, was that USAID had found a publication in the POPLINE database that they thought was should not be there because of the Helms Amendment, because the Helms Amendment also restricts funding for POPLINE, and they thought that this particular publication was abortion advocacy, and I want to show it to you. It's actually our IPAS publication, our abortion magazine. And because of that, the Johns Hopkins University staff at POPLINE took sort of overcorrected the action and made abortion a stop term, so it was not searchable. That decision was actually reversed as soon as it got to the dean of Johns Hopkins University, so abortion was reinstated. However, the publication was not. So basically, under the Helms Amendment, POPLINE cannot carry IPAS materials that are deemed under the Helms Amendment and other materials. It's not just IPAS. We just happen to be single out deemed abortion advocacy materials. So in addition to all of those effects out there outside the U.S., it also is a tricky law because it has been interpreted to be able to censor some materials. And just to conclude, these are three of our country directors who went to D.C. to talk about the impact of the global gag rule. I think we have reason to be hopeful that we won't be living with the global gag rule shortly after January, if I can be so bold to say that. But the Helms Amendment, I think, will take a long time to get rid of. And so we're, IPASS is looking out to work with partners and to bring some more of our country staff to Washington and other places, too, to try to start the conversation and inform people about how the Helms Amendment for these many, many years that it's been in effect is really harming women. Thank you.
Okay, our next presenter.